Lake Effect returns with more of our first day of coverage in our Project Milwaukee Barriers to Achievement in NPS series. I'm Bonnie North. Education policy is a hot topic, and today there are many voices heard in the debate. But at a certain point, the question becomes, who is really in control of our schools? School districts not only have to answer to local boards of education and state officials, but to national performance guidelines as well. And many times schools get caught in the crossfire. Just last year, Governor Jim Doyle and Mayor Tom Barrett made a much-debated and ultimately unsuccessful bid for mayoral control over Milwaukee Public Schools. With so many voices of influence clamoring to be heard and so many people to answer to, how do actual schools make sense of all the sometimes contradictory guidelines and debate? Barbara Bales is particularly interested in what it all means for teachers bridging the gap between policy and their students. Bales is an assistant professor at the UWM School of Education. She argues that what she calls the tug of war between policymakers can breed ineffective teaching methods and negatively impact students. Bales says how teachers were educated was traditionally under the purview of local authorities, but she tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce that over the last 100 years, national forces have gained significant control, and she explains why.
I'd like to believe that it's because we have a persistent achievement gap. I think that is a really popular way to think about it. I also think that the economic race that we're in globally contributes to how we see our competition around the world and in the countries in which we compete economically. It's a national controlled system. So while I'd like to say that it's about this persistent achievement gap, and I use that, and I think every person in education focuses on that, there are businesses and economic forces that try to pull the system in terms of the preparation of workers for an economic society.
What's been the traditional argument for having local control, not only over curriculum in the classroom, but also over the preparation of teachers?
Well, historically, that would be from the one-room schoolrooms that we had from the very beginning of time in this particular country. And that local control was usually one teacher was hired by either the mayor and then the school boards came on board. But it was this idea that we know what's best for the children who go through that school, and we ought to have a role in controlling what happens. And those were some pretty fundamental beliefs, which I think local school boards still have about their role in what happens to children, the children that they care for.
Tell me a little bit more about this tug of war for control between local and national forces. Has it stymied reform efforts within the classroom? Has it hamstrung teachers into not necessarily being able to initiate perhaps new methods of teaching or different curricula in their classrooms?
That's a really powerful question, and I think it's multifaceted. So I think I'll try to tease it apart first from a national perspective and then look at it from a state and then look at it from a classroom teacher, because I was a classroom teacher for 17 years. So I think if we take it from the national perspective first, if we believe that this persistent achievement gap is what drives educational reform, then somebody had to step in and say that local authorities weren't doing it well enough. So we had the Elementary and Secondary Education Act in 1965 that helped talk about inclusiveness. And we had in 1966, we had a lot of other policies around social change and trying to be more inclusive about who public schools were for. That brought about a switch in how we thought the purposes of schools could be broadened. And then as economics often do and politics often do, we got swings to the right and to the left. There was this economic push in 1984 to say that schools were not preparing workers. So reforms became much more mandated from the national level. What they ended up doing was forcing states to make decisions, and they did that by withholding funds. In this case, under Goals 2000 and then under the ESEA 2001 rendition, commonly referred to as No Child Left Behind, states were told you need to put in standards of learning for students and standards of performance for teachers. And if you don't do that, we're going to withhold any federal funding for your programs. So in the state of Wisconsin, raced around and put together a policy called PI 34. So federal authorities leveraged states to do certain things and thereby kind of stripped them of their own authority. Then states in turn said, okay, school districts, we now have these state tests, we have these state assessments, we have these state standards, we're going to ask you to implement them. And the more pushback that happened, the more punitive those demands became if you didn't comply. So we went from testing every 4th, 8th, and 12th grade to the drop of the high school exit exam here in this state and to an almost yearly assessment of academic growth in students. There were lots of problems with that. For one thing, every state still had their own set of standards. So if you were to look nationally, we still had 49 states. One state held out, but 49 states with different sets of standards. No state ever got on board with making sure that their assessments lined up with what they expected students to know. And that created havoc for classroom teachers. It also created havoc from a national perspective because you could no longer look across the country and compare what happened in the state of Wisconsin to with students who live in Mississippi or what students who live in California, for example. So there was this whole idea of we want everybody to show us that students are learning for whatever reasons they have, and there was no way to compare states across. To a classroom teacher who's trying their very best to do what's best for the students sitting in front of them, and I like to fundamentally believe that. First, they have how they've done teaching and learning forever and ever, or even just a year, and now they have the state coming in and saying, we have these standards of expectation, and not only that, but we have these assessments that don't really match what we want them to know, but we're going to test kids anyway.
So teachers are basically being made to answer to multiple levels of assessment.
Exactly. And that creates, from a policy perspective, we get street-level bureaucrats is what the phrase is, of people in classrooms trying to negotiate and manage all these demands. We get state-level policymakers who also are bureaucrats and want to control things and add Wisconsin's own spin or Minnesota's or California's spin on things. And national authorities who are pretty removed from looking at a student's face.
It may seem like an obvious question, but how are these issues playing out here in Milwaukee public schools? I mean, can we look at the whole recent debate over mayoral control as kind of an outgrowth of this broader tug of war?
I think that we can. I think whenever there is a series of policies made at multiple levels, we like to refer to that as policy congestion. And it makes it very complicated to respond to, in the case of Milwaukee Public Schools, to respond to the national authorities' designation as a district identified for improvement and state-level demands on how you're going to do that. I work with classroom teachers, and I think that the majority of classroom teachers are working very, very hard within a system that sometimes strangleholds their access to data, puts a stranglehold on what they're able to do, either by the structure of the day or how much what their professional development is restricted to. And so I think for a classroom teacher, they often feel that they're – and this is a phrase that I've come to understand in the research I've been doing – they're running on empty. They can only hold on to the fact that they honestly feel they're doing a really good job with the kids that they see 150, 180, 200 of them a day.
One of the biggest problems that MPS is facing is the retention of good teachers and keeping new teachers in the system longer after they've invested the training and the time, keeping teachers longer than, say, even just 3 years. I mean, does this play into that, causing so many to leave MPS?
First of all, that 3 to 5 year figure is not, you know, specific to MPS. It's a national figure. People who go into teaching go in for a variety of reasons. And historically, teacher education programs haven't been known to deny certification to people who may not have been or may not be the best teachers for the classroom. But we have a huge demand, and so, which is why we have new rules around teacher ed from national and state authorities, is that there's this understanding that good teachers are the pivotal person to help students learn. And so how do you do that? How do you sort through all of the people who want to be teachers and decide, well, you're fabulous, you're going to be good, you're going to do no harm, or you're just disastrous and we're not going to certify you. And historically, only 2% of people don't make it through a teacher ed program. So when we get into a classroom, the rubber hits the road and people either decide they like teaching or they don't. One of the new programs that President Obama has put forward is this teacher residency model. And that's not a new idea about preparing teachers similar to the way that doctors are prepared. What that does is the theory is that it reduces the blunt, oh my gosh, I'm in a classroom by myself, to flattening that out to a 18-month or 2-year experience in the classroom while they're learning without being the teacher of record. I think there are lots of things we don't do well in teacher ed. I think it's worth pursuing other ways of thinking about how we prepare teachers.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about teacher preparation. In one of your papers, you discussed this idea of teaching to the middle as kind of being a hallmark of traditional teacher preparation programs, and maybe having that be at the expense of slower learners or students that simply require more attention. Are traditional teacher preparation programs really getting teachers prepared to come into an urban district like Milwaukee Public Schools where they're dealing with so many outside issues?
Teaching to the middle is not how we think we ought to think about teaching anymore. As our research has expanded, we've learned more and more about the cognitive processes of learning. We know that the middle is very narrow and actually the edges are very broad. We need to rethink that the idea about teaching and learning in a classroom should be student-centered, and we should meet students' needs however they come to us. I won't talk too much about the economic controls on how kids come to school less prepared than those from more affluent areas, because I think that's a situation beyond what we do in teacher ed. But good teachers should start with who's in front of them in the classroom, no matter where they're at and what their talents are. But then they're forced to be in graded classrooms. So if I'm coming in and I don't read at a third grade level, it's third grade, and I either have to learn how to read by the end of third grade or some test is going to tell me I can't be passed forward. Should that be my teacher's responsibility to make up 2 years? In part, some of the makeup should be on the teacher. But the other part of it is that who determined what third grade was? And if we thought more broadly about getting rid of graded classrooms, going back to a one-room schoolroom, for example, we might see more success with kids learning rather than thinking that, oh, gee, you didn't get to the end of third grade at a third grade reading level, and it's your fault. So I think that we have so many policies coming together right now that sometimes it's important to think about maybe the system needs to be different.
One of the points you make in one of your papers is that in some teacher certification programs that the future teachers are being instructed in ways of the past, that they're going into classrooms teaching in methods that have been used before them that some might argue clearly haven't worked.
We refer to that as the socialization process, and it's a very powerful force. And when we think about new teachers, the power relationship, and even student teachers, the power relationship between a cooperating teacher who's going to then evaluate a student teacher, or a new teacher and their mentor, or the person who's going to evaluate them, it takes a very strong person who has a very strong research backing in why they teach the way they do to argue for why something should be different. And again, we talk about systems and cultures. Our systems in schools and our cultures in schools aren't set up to nurture necessarily that kind of speaking up.
There's also the issue of assessment and basically measuring teacher performance based on the performance of their students. And you have some on one side arguing for things like merit pay as a means to encourage teachers to really get their students' performance grades up. And then there are other arguments saying teachers shouldn't be basically hamstrung by having to make unreasonable gains in student performance over 1 year. How do we reconcile both of these kinds of arguments to really have a system where teachers are really held accountable fairly?
There are two parts to your question that I think are worth separating. And one is the idea of fairness. And the other is, who are we accountable to as a teacher? And as a teacher, they're accountable first to the child and to help that child learn. That doesn't often get translated into evaluations. The word about teacher effectiveness, as it moves from teacher quality to teacher effectiveness, has a causal relationship. And that's complicated, because if I'm a classroom teacher and I can get a child to come to school 5 days a week, and maybe last year they only came 3 days a week, sure, we'll make the assumption that they might be learning more, but that effort should be recognized as well. I think of kids in alternative schools, for example, and getting them to the point of regularly attending takes a lot of personal initiative that's not measured on any exam. The other part of that is, what are you calling learning and how do you measure that? And those become much more complex. We haven't yet come to a decision on what we call learning and then two, how we measure it. Then the next aspect would be about whether or not that measurement is fair.
Well, I'm sure we could talk about this for much longer, but let me say, Barbara Bales, thank you so much for coming in and framing these issues for us.
And thank you for inviting me.
Barbara Bales is an assistant professor at the UWM School of Education in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction. She's also a former middle-level teacher. Her research focuses on teacher education, teacher preparation, and the tug of war between local, state, and national educational policy. After a short break, we'll continue our Project Milwaukee coverage with a conversation about teacher turnover and how it affects students. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.